unreal, uncensored, unradio.
CliffCentral.com.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Happily, happy. We keep coming back. That's us. I'm joined in studio by Daily Maverick reporter Greg Nicholson. Always good having you here.
Thanks for having me.
Fantastic. Now, today we're just going to jump right in. We really want to talk about something that happened over the past week where we had our police officer in Alex, storm into a police station and killing four people. So it sounded like a domestic abuse situation that just got out of control, Greg. And we really just want to talk to the police spokesperson just to understand what's really going on. So we're just going to go quickly to Lieutenant General Solomon Makgale to talk to talk about this issue. Lieutenant General, are you here with us?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for coming on. Now, we really just want to talk about what happened over the past week, where we had a policeman storm into the Alex police station, and we want to.
Yeah.
And we want to just really understand the state of the mental state of some of the police officers in the country. So issues of trauma, substance abuse, alcohol abuse, and we want to get that side of the story. We don't hear it too often. Sometimes the police don't have the best reputation, but we want to take some time to understand what's in the mind state and what kind of traumas are some of our police officers going through. Could you shed some light on that?
Yes, I think it's generally accepted that anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
Policing is a dangerous task.
Yep.
And anyone who undertakes this job would, you know, goes into it knowing, and there is sufficient training done to mentally prepare everyone that joins the service that it's dangerous, particularly here in South Africa, where the crimes that are committed are often extremely violent.
Yes.
Now, police officers have to attend to different crime scene. It could be a vehicle accident. It could be a truck that has exploded, somebody that committed suicide, people that have been stabbed, that sort of thing. So it does take its toll on people. And to assist our officers, we have a program where we've employed psychologists, we've got social workers, because we need to also give them assistance with issues, you know, as finances or other issues at home. And we also have spiritual services that come in after incidents to pray with people that are affected, but also just to talk to them, just to, you know, do a little bit of a debriefing. And those that are, you know, feel that perhaps they will need more help, because you'll never know. You know, I might appear strong now after an incident, and a few months later it hits me. So there is psychological services that's available. What we've also done, we've gone the extra mile. We've engaged with our medical aid, PolMed, to say that individuals that do not feel comfortable approaching the psychological services that's provided at work, they can approach a private service provider, and the medical aid would pay for that.
Lieutenant General, you've spoken recently about a suicide summit set up by the National Police Commissioner, Rio Piejo, in 2013, and I'd just like to quote former police minister Natiem Tetua from that summit. He said, police officers are often reluctant to tell their commanders about their problems because they fear their careers will be destroyed. So they make the mistake of trying to solve their problems quietly, and that often leads to alcohol or substance abuse or suicide.
Yes.
Since then, what have you done to try and increase this problem and get police officers to engage these sort of trauma services?
Yeah, look, I think what you've got to do is to demystify all of those things, and more importantly, deal with the stigma that is attached to this. You know, there's the prevailing culture, not only in police, but in society, that tigers don't cry. So, you know, there's this macho attitude towards some of these things, and people feel that it's better to appear strong in front of your colleagues. It's better to deal with this thing yourself rather than tell a professional person that can assist you. But what we've been doing, we set up domestic violence and substance abuse deaths across all the different provinces, where we proactively distributing information, talking to employees, especially during the debriefing sessions, so that they understand that there is help available and that their promotion or success in the police is not going to be determined by the outcome of that process. And I think what the minister was referring to was exactly this attitude that people think that because I am receiving assistance from psychological services, I will not get promoted. There might be, you know, instances here and there where some of the commanders use this as an excuse to say, but yeah, we're not certain of your mental state, therefore we can't deploy you here or we can't give you promotion and so on, which is total abuse of power. And we've also said to our employees, as and when those instances come up, inform top management, the provincial commissioner's office or the national commissioner's office, so that those matters can be attended to.
And Solomon, just looking back, I think I saw read in a 2011 article some figures on the trauma counsellors in the SAPS. It said the SAPS has 535 trauma counsellors serving 172,000 personnel. Has that number changed? Are there more trauma counsellors available now?
We are continuing to increase the number of counsellors. I don't have the updated figure offhand.
Mm-hmm.
But currently we've got about 60,000 people that are being assisted by our psychological services unit and social workers. I have not included in that number spiritual services.
Mm-hmm.
These are just where people are going to professionals. It's more than 60,000.
Okay. And what about the numbers on...
also help available
okay.
with the medical aid, yeah.
Okay. And what about the numbers on suicide? So there's published figures on suicides from 2009 till 2011, and we had, I think, a high of almost 100 police suicides at one point. Is that still a figure that we're tracking?
In terms of suicide,
yeah.
we do have figures, but what we try and do, based on the advice that we've received from our counselors, is that it's better to focus on the programs that we offer, which is Choose Life, because the more we emphasize the number of people that commit suicide and so on, then some people may see this as a way out of their problem. And the problems vary, by the way. It's not just because of exposure to trauma.
Mm.
It could be that somebody has been found to be HIV positive because of the programs that we do. So we incorporate all of that, issues of lifestyle, issues of health, so that people do not see whatever illness, whatever financial difficulties they may have, they may not see that as the end of the world, that there is help available. And it would be good if all of us as society, because the police serve me, they serve you, that we encourage them that there is help available. If you don't want the one that is offered by the police, PolMed is there to assist you, take advantage of that, and there's no need to be shy or embarrassed about seeking help. You as an individual, you know yourself better, and if you feel that you've reached a stage where you cannot cope, get a professional to help you.
No, we hear you, and we really commend the work you're doing in partnering with the external parties. I think what we're really trying to find is some kind of measure that we can track across time to see progress. And I understand suicide is a really tough measure, but it feels like an objective thing that you can say between 2009 onwards, it was here, and these are the programs we put in place, and this is the progress we've seen. So what numbers are you tracking to say that over time we are doing better at giving people counseling help, at making sure the domestic situations are better, the financial situations? What measures are the police tracking to say we are making progress on this issue?
What we are tracking is the number of people that attend the individual sessions,
mm-hmm.
with the psychologist or the social workers. Social workers is to assist when there are problems at home, in addition to problems at work. So they will then involve the family and try and assist the member through that process. We were not keeping figures before. So since the summit, it was one of the outcomes to say, let us start tracking the number of people that take the services. So we're currently sitting at just over 60,000. The number of people that have had interaction with the people from spiritual services is in excess of 100,000. So it's we're starting to, we see traction, but it's not at the rate that we'd like to see it at, because this is, it's always difficult to change human behavior. It's not a simple thing. And when there are myths that are attached to our attempts to try and change this behavior, then it makes the job even more difficult. But at the end of the day, what we do our best at is to avail information and for people to know that there is help available. That's really the biggest message that we try and get out there. One can never fully control the behavior of someone once they're outside, once they're on their own and they make their own decision. But you can try and influence it by giving them the correct information and messages.
Mm-hmm. I just want to link, Lieutenant General, the problem that you can't necessarily control the actions of these individuals once they get into such trouble. And is there, can you tell us about if there is a link between psychological and social issues amongst police officers, and then those police officers then going on to give bad service or commit crimes?
Let me put it this way. I did elaborate a little bit about the challenges at work in terms of exposure to trauma.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that we're picking up from our members is they don't want people to feel sorry for them, but they want acceptance in society. And we're struggling at the moment because so one finds that there's pressure at work because, you know, you got to perform and the exposure to all this traumatic things. When you are out in society and you try to unwind and try not to think about work, and, you know, you are made to feel terrible for, you know, just because you're a police officer. So they find that there's pressure coming from all fronts. And what we try and do is to encourage them. You know, when you become a police officer, you don't do it because you want to be rich. You don't do it because you want to praise, you want praise from society. You're doing it because you realize that there is a problem and you want to help. And if, as you know, different communities, we can rally around our police officers, give them the necessary support, and work with them to solve some of the social problems that we are seeing, then I think we can go some way into assisting them and making this less and less of a problem in the police.
Absolutely, okay. Lieutenant General. I think our role is really to still be critical and hold the police accountable while still accepting them as members of society and understanding the tough job they do. Thank you for coming on, and we'll make sure to speak to you again as we watch this issue. And finally, before we let you go, is also just to wish you a happy birthday.
No, thank you very much. Yes, my first time on your show, and thanks for wishing me happy birthday.
Absolutely.
I'm going to enjoy my lunch.
Please, I hope you can take the afternoon off, and I'm sure we'll speak to you soon.
All right, thank
fantastic.
You.
Fantastic, thank you. Greg, just as we were talking to Lieutenant General Makgale, the national spokesperson of the national police, I just find it difficult to reconcile. On one hand, we're finding ourselves often very critical of police. We saw the tragic scenes from Marikana. We see what happens in communities, and there's a lot of abuse of power. There's corruption, and I'm finding it quite hard to balance that with being sympathetic for the really, really tough job. It can be a pretty shit job, and just trying to balance those in my mind.
I think we have to look at the issue holistically, because on the one hand, in a violent society such as South Africa's, and I'm sure the Lieutenant General would have given us the crime statistics, which in some regards are improving, in some regards are worsening, but the fact is we do have a violent society. We want the police to do their jobs and be effective and come to our rescue if we need them. But at the same time, I think it is difficult to recognize.
You see, that's the thing. And I remember, I was trying to think of this to be prepared for the show. And I think just looking at it on a human level and just being like putting yourself in that position. In that position, I think it's a tough one.
So we have to recognize while they're dealing with all these shitty problems that they are going through their own difficulties. They are dealing with these situations too, and there's causes for these situations. And it's not just like these guys are just completely bad guys.
Yeah.
They're dealing with, you know, horrible conditions. Imagine being shot at, coming to a crime scene and seeing a raped child or something like that, you know.
And that happens regularly.
It's going to fuck you up. Yeah. Like, so I think you do have to understand those issues and call on the SAPS and society to help them solve those issues, while at the same time, I think it's understandable to be outraged if the causes of those issues are things like killing or police brutality or inefficient service. We can still be outraged at those things, but I don't think it makes enough sense just to call for the police to improve their services and stop committing brutalities or atrocities or things like that. We have to look at the causes of them, and they are multiple, and trauma, the trauma police deal with is one of those causes.
Absolutely. I mean, we'll continue to watch the issue, and like I mentioned before, I think it's just that twofold. How do we hold police accountable at an institutional level while still being human about it and understanding that they're still men and women at the end of the day? If you're just tuning in, this is the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We've just been talking about trauma within the police, and we'll just be changing topics slightly. We want to talk about the Oscar Pistorius trial, and we'll just be talking to Rebecca Davis, our Daily Maverick reporter. Rebecca, are you here with us?
I am indeed. Hi, guys.
Fantastic. How are you doing?
Not too bad. I'm just in quite a heated parliamentary sports portfolio committee where opposition is trying to persuade the ANC MPs on the committee that Danny Jordaan and Mr. Olifant should appear in front of parliament, but ANC MPs are adamant that only Sports Minister Mbalula should be made to appear.
I get the feeling, Rebecca, you're trying to avoid discussing Oscar Pistorius.
I'm not at all. I'm just explaining where my head is.
No, that's all. I want to hear more about that. Okay, so just quickly on Oscar. Rebecca, I was following this issue, and I saw that it looks like he's going to be out of prison in 10 months, and my gut reaction was that doesn't sound like a lot of time. That sounds pretty light.
It is light, but we must note that this is all completely procedurally legitimate, all totally legal. It is absolutely above board. The fact of the matter is that if you get convicted of a crime with a sentence not exceeding 5 years and you display good behavior in jail, if you undergo rehabilitation programs, you don't cause any problems, then you are eligible for release once one-sixth of your sentence has been served. And apparently all those factors apply to the Pistorius. They will also have looked at things like, is he likely to be a danger to his community? Is he likely to, you know, go after anyone to do with his victim? The answers to those, they obviously felt was very unlikely. So, you know, as far as checking the boxes go, it doesn't seem like anything untoward has happened here.
Rebecca, while all the boxes are checked, well, one thing Kingsley and I were talking about is this normal? And what I mean is that would someone else who committed a similar crime, similar sentence, be able to get this parole after 10 months without Pistorius's, you know, high-powered legal team and fame?
I don't know, because I haven't looked into, and I should, I suppose, I haven't looked into previous cases of culpable homicide which have carried exactly the same sentence and so forth. But, I mean, given that correctional services must be aware that there's a lot of scrutiny on this case, I think it would be unlikely that they'd be making various concessions here. I have to imagine that they know that there will be, you know, people will be looking out to trip them up, especially because, you know, the response has been one of consternation that he's being released so soon. So perhaps call me naive, but I don't think that they're doing anything special here. I'd like to think that if the system runs smoothly, which we know sometimes it doesn't, but for other reasons, then other people in the same boat would get the same treatment.
Okay. So now Pistorius is going to get released from prison. The soccer games, Radovan Krejca, will be over. What happens now?
he gets released into house arrest, which will mean that I assume he will go to his uncle's house where he was staying beforehand, because we know he's had to sell his properties and he is broke.
Mm.
House arrest is not going to be Oscar going jawling around town and on holiday to Mozambique. I mean, he's going to have to be in his house at night, I'm pretty sure, every evening. He's going to have to report to his local correctional office, the parole office, frequently, and they will visit him at home as well. He almost certainly won't be able to drink alcohol, and they'll be testing him for that as well. He'll be able to go out to things like work if he has a job. He'll be able to go out to sports, to do sports, so he'll probably be allowed to train, and he'll be allowed to go to church. Beyond that, though, it's not like he'll be out at parties or anything like that. You are still expected, you know, you are under arrest. You're under correctional supervision. You're not allowed to live, you know, a free and normal life. It'll be interesting to see whether they decide that he should do some community service in addition to that.
Because he said he wanted to work with kids, right?
He did. He said he wanted to work with kids, exactly, and whether they will make him do further programs, some form of rehabilitation, anger management, and so forth. They may make him attend more programs, even though apparently he has already done a few of those in prison.
Mm. Has there been any suggestion, and can he even return to competitive running? Because I find that would be completely bizarre if all of a sudden murder accused is, you know, running in international competitions or something.
I haven't heard anyone suggest that, and his family and lawyers, whenever they've spoken to the media during Pistorius' incarceration, have claimed that it's never even been raised, that Pistorius has expressed no interest in it, etc. I mean, obviously he'd be pretty out of shape for a start, because, you know, he obviously hasn't been able to train in the way that you'd need to maintain an international standard. I also wonder what his, I mean, certainly he won't be able to travel internationally while he's under house arrest, so that would be another thing. So certainly for the duration of his sentence, he won't be able to travel. And then, of course, we need to look at whether he will still be allowed to travel to certain countries, countries like the U.S., etc. I'm not sure whether they do let you in. I think perhaps with culpable homicide they might, with a murder conviction perhaps not.
I suppose it's something we'll continue to watch, but I don't know, maybe I'm just naive, but I feel like if you get to go to work, you get to sort of, you know, go home, read a book, you know, have a drink, it doesn't sound too terrible, but that's just me.
Well, I mean, I know what you mean, Kingsley. I saw Deep Fried Man tweeted something similar earlier about why is house arrest a punishment. I hate leaving my house as long as Mr. Delivery can come. What's the problem? And I think that a lot of people will feel the same way, but I guess we haven't been in that situation potentially over the course of years.
And, no, absolutely, absolutely. I'm just thinking of it as a guaranteed get out of jail free card. All awkward family weddings and get togethers. Like,
yeah, that's right.
House arrest. Sorry, guys, I can't make it. Now, Rebecca, something you brought up earlier. You're in Parliament for the discussion around who's going to be accountable to Parliament on this issue. So, what's it looking like? Is it going to be Danny O'Dan? Is it going to be Fikile Mbalula? What's it looking like?
Well, the whole point is. Yeah. The reason why the opposition parties don't want to see the minister brought before Parliament is for the obvious reason that Fikile Mbalula had nothing to do with the bribes. He was not the sports minister at the time. Yeah. What did he know about it? The only thing he can report is based on basically hearsay or whatever.
Rebecca? Okay, I think we've lost Rebecca there.
I think we've lost her. Anyway, we're just talking to Rebecca Davis about the Oscar Pistorius trial, and lastly, who's going to appear in front of Parliament to actually answer to what's going on with the corruption allegations around FIFA and the 2010 World Cup. So the ANC sounds like they're pushing to have Fikile Mbalula appear in front of Parliament, which one could suggest is not the worst idea. That's, because he was not the sports minister at the time.
And he's already shown, he's delivered two press conferences on the issues, he's shown he's comfortable talking about it, and he's largely just tried to push all the allegations aside in defense of the local organizing committee and FIFA.
Yeah, which would be quite different to somebody who was acting at the time and who may have a bit more tough questions to answer if he were actually sitting and part of SAFA and part of the bid committee at the time.
Mm. I think he's just more the government's bulldog to fight off all corruption allegation claims. And he's done a okay job. I saw the weekend papers really hammered Mbalula for this claim that the money given to the Caribbean Soccer Union wasn't a bribe, and for it coming out almost immediately after that in the Chuck Blazer testimony to the US authorities, that he said they received a bribe for the 2010 bid. So it hasn't gone well for him in terms of his defenses so far, but he's doing his best.
Yeah, I suppose we'll continue to watch. If you're just tuning in, it's the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We talked about issues of trauma in the police, talked about Oscar Pistorius, issues at FIFA, and also just briefly spoke to Rebecca Davis. Please, please, please go out and get her book, Best White and Other Anxious Delusions. I just finished my copy last week, and it is absolutely hilarious. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back shortly. CliffCentral.com. If you're just tuning in, you're tuned into the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Quite a show lined up. Earlier we spoke to the national spokesperson of the South African police, talking about trauma amongst the police. So we had a situation where a police officer walked into a police station, and this was part of a domestic abuse situation he was having at home, and ended up killing four people. And so we were just digging into the sort of the mind state of a regular policeman or woman, and what trauma are they facing. Also talked about issues with FIFA. We had Rebecca Davis live at the parliamentary conversation about who's actually going to appear in front of parliament to discuss the issues of corruption at FIFA. And now we want to switch topics slightly and go into talking about the South African National AIDS Council, and they've released a stigma report. And it's something we've been looking at. I'm joined in studio by Greg Nicholson, and we're just trying to figure out how does one quantify stigma? How does it play into the issue of the epidemic itself and how we combat it. So we'll be talking to Dr. Farid Abdullah, the CEO of the South African National AIDS Council, to give us some context on this. Dr. Abdullah, are you here with us?
Yes, hello.
How are you today?
Yes, very well, thanks. Thank you for having me on your show.
No, absolutely. Well, we just really want to talk about the stigma report that was recently released and try and place it in the context of where we are as a country in combating the AIDS epidemic. So before we get to the issue of stigma itself and the report, could you give us an idea of where we are as a country in terms of the fight against HIV and AIDS? I think we've had times where we were really struggling with the fight against HIV and AIDS and feeling like we were not doing as well as we should. And then we've had times where we were celebrating the progress. So if you could just sort of contextualize this, how are we doing? Are we making progress? Are we doing well? Where are we in the world? And so on.
Well, so the short story is that we are making lots of progress, but we have still so much more to do.
Mm.
As you know, we used to be a country which refused to provide antiretroviral treatment. Now we are a country that has 3 million people on antiretroviral treatment. That is the largest number of people on treatment in the world, and that's good progress. We're also doing very well with treating HIV in pregnancy, and that has reduced the childhood AIDS, HIV in children, or pediatric AIDS, as they call it. But when we look at the new infections, we still have more than 400,000 new infections every year. So the focus has to shift now to prevention, because if we continue to have new infections, we'll reach a point where we can no longer afford to provide treatment. More and more people will need treatment. So we have to close the gap. You know? In summary, that's where we are at the moment with HIV.
Okay, I mean, that's great context. So I think it was a slow start, we can agree, as a country, and it sounds like we've made tremendous progress, and it's really just about really finishing on some of the great work we've done. Then could you tell us a bit about the stigma and discrimination? What do we mean by stigma and discrimination?
So there are different forms of stigma.
Mm-hmm.
When someone has HIV, they get treated badly by other people.
Yep.
That's what we call external stigma. But we also have a form of stigma, which we call internal stigma, which is a sort of self-inflicted stigma. It's self-imposed. It's the way people who have HIV undervalue themselves. We've never known the extent of this problem. So what SANAC has done, the National AIDS Council, that is we've done a survey of 10,000 people living with HIV. And what we found is that the general external stigma, has come down. It's still present. We still need to do more about it. But internal stigma is quite high, with about 43% of people living with HIV self-stigmatizing. And we also found that TB stigma is a growing phenomenon.
Now, Doctor, just tell us a little bit about, before we get deeply into the results, tell us a little bit about how you did this survey.
So it's very hard to get people living with HIV to talk openly. So what we did is we went to networks of people living with HIV, groups, reached about 10,000 people living with HIV through these networks. We sampled 18 districts throughout the country, so we got a good representative sample. And we asked them a series of questions about whether they are, how they're treated by other people, what they think about their own disease, and what sorts of problems they have if they go to health services or schools. This was probably done as a scientific survey. But the trick was really to get people living with HIV to interview the others. So we had more than 120 people who are living with HIV doing the interview.
I think that's a nice, I can imagine that would really do a lot for the level of comfort of speaking about some of these issues. If you're talking to somebody who you feel can relate to the reality of also living with HIV and AIDS.
And Doctor, when you say external stigma is down, does that mean South African society is becoming more accepting of individuals living with HIV?
Well, I think so. It's not a precise measurement because it's the first time we do the survey. And we can't say scientifically that it's down, but from other little surveys that we've had over the years, we feel that this result, reflects an improvement. So South Africans are responding. They are more understanding. They've learned to live with HIV. Now, what helped us to come to this conclusion is that we actually had comparisons with other countries. So this survey has been done in other countries, and we have less external stigma in South Africa than most of the other countries on the African continent.
Yeah.
So that's a good sign.
So I think what our minds are going to now is like we have this what sounds like a groundbreaking sort of survey and body of work. In terms of we've got 10,000 people around the country to really understand what the realities are for them living with HIV and AIDS. But how do we use this for policy design, policy implementation? How does this improve how we carry out prevention, how we carry out treatment? And what do you think are the implications for this for the fight against HIV and AIDS?
Well, the most important thing is that when you do the survey once, you can do something to reduce stigma and then do it again in 3 years' time and see if you are really making a difference. And in fact, that's one of the main objectives that SANAC is trying to achieve here. Instead of just relying on a general feeling or anecdotal information, our job is to properly measure how we are doing with HIV, including with a subject like stigma, then to make sure that programs are implemented, and then we monitor it again in 3 years. So, well, that's the most important thing. The survey tells us where the problem might be worse, and what we found is that the three provinces which have got the highest HIV prevalence also have the highest levels of stigma. That's KwaZulu-Natal, Free State, and Mpumalanga.
Yes.
So it helps us to target our campaigns in those provinces.
I mean, absolutely. I think you're right. It gives us a baseline to work from and also perhaps a more targeted approach. I think it's quite phenomenal that we're able to quantify something like something that are so social and feel quite subjective, stigma and discrimination, and now start to combat that. So thank you, Dr. Abdullah. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have, but thank you for the great work you're doing, and I'm sure we'll have you on the show again soon.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Okay, fantastic. I mean, Greg, it sounds like I'm a little success story. I mean, you don't want to call it before we're done. The job is not done. But we complain so much about government and public sector execution. And it's nice to speak with somebody in the public sector who can say we're making progress. It was a slow start yet, but we're making progress. We're doing surveys that are first of their kind, and we're getting somewhere.
I think the progress more is We do, yes, have broad progress on particularly access to treatment services now for HIV, which, you know, 10 years ago just wasn't in the country. But I think this new stigma report, one of the key things about it is that we're sort of measuring something that, you know, hasn't been really measured so well before, but it has a huge, huge impact on how people seek on prevention and treatment measures.
And absolutely. I think the key thing now is try to take what are sort of more macro stats and very big and try to get perhaps a more personalized perspective on what it may be like living with HIV and AIDS and issues of stigma and discrimination, and give perspective on where we are as a country on some of these things. So we'll be speaking to Justice Edwin Cameron. Justice Cameron, are you here with us?
Good afternoon. How are you?
Fine, thank you. We've just been speaking to Dr. Farid Abdullah of the South African National AIDS Council on their stigma and discrimination report on people living with HIV and AIDS. So we're really digging into issues of stigma and discrimination and where we are as a country, perhaps even as a continent, on societal sort of treatment and the societal implications of living with HIV and AIDS and what we need to do with that. So you've been quite outspoken on issues of discrimination in gender and in homosexuality in living with HIV and AIDS. So we really wanted to get your perspective and your experiences on the issues of stigma and discrimination. Could you walk us through some of the perspective you have and maybe some issues you faced over the years?
Yes, with pleasure, and it's good to be on your show.
Thank you.
I think we've got to start with the fact that HIV/AIDS has been around for 34 years now. It was in May 1981 that in the United States the weekly morbidity and mortality reports of the Centers for Disease Control first identified this strange disease. And the point is that from it, the very start, it has probably been the most stigmatized disease in humankind's history. There are other stigmatized diseases, leprosy, there are other diseases that people fear, Ebola, for rational reasons, because they are highly contagious. But we knew within a very few years of the onset of the epidemic that it was very difficult to get AIDS. You basically need an injection of infected bodily fluid through a needle, through the skin, or you need to have sex, unprotected sexual intercourse. Despite that, we're still struggling 3.5 decades after the onset of the epidemic with enormous discrimination and with enormous stigma. And we see that in various ways. I mean, the first is that people are still very scared to talk. Mm-hmm. Things have improved. There was a mass testing campaign 3 years ago, which the government deserves congratulations for, the health minister and the president for launching the campaign. The antiretroviral program has been tremendous in getting people to talk, but it's still the disease of silence and stigma and fear.
Mm. Justice Cameron, one of the key things seems to be that I'd imagine in combating stigma is distributing or increasing knowledge and information about HIV and AIDS issues. You would imagine would help reduce the stigma when people understand that there are treatments available, there are only certain ways to become HIV positive, more limited than perhaps, certain people would have said in the past. But even now, that when I think a lot of people would know more about HIV, we still seem to confront these stigmas. Why do you think that is, even though we have so much more information available?
Well, I think your point is right. In fact, we know that the level of awareness about HIV is almost 98% in our country. You won't find a suburban or township, urban or rural, black or white, male or female, gay or straight South African who doesn't know about HIV/AIDS. Secondly, the level of knowledge is very high. There are people who still don't know. There are people who don't want to know at some level of personal denial. But most people, up to 90% of people, know that the virus is difficult to transmit, that you get it through sex, and that you can use condoms to prevent it, to prevent transmission. The problem is more intractable than that. The problem is that this is a disease that's sexually transmitted.
Mm-hmm.
And until we can talk with less constraint and inhibition and less fear about sex itself, any disease that is transmitted sexually is going to have a stigma to it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reasons are complicated. I look at them in my book, Justice, A Personal Account. I try to understand why does the fact that this disease is sexually transmitted contributes so heavily to the stigma.
Mm-hmm. It must, I'd imagine, being a sexually transmitted disease must make it more difficult for more conservative families, and you know, which there are many of in the country, and societies, to discuss these issues.
Well, difficult for all of us.
Yeah. Mm.
And, of course, that brings me to the great unspoken issue in stigma, which is internalized stigma.
Mm-hmm.
And we know very well what externalized stigma is. We know that it's discrimination, it's condemnation, yeah. it's harsh words, it's violence, it's chucking people out of their homes and their jobs. We can do something about externalized discrimination. We can legislate against it. We can tell people not to do it. The much more difficult thing is when the stigma is embedded inside the person's own consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very difficult thing. It's the under-researched issue in the last 34 years of the epidemic.
Mm.
Because many people with HIV and at risk of HIV blame themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, how do you account for the fact that we don't have public figures in Africa who don't talk about their own HIV status? We've got 35 million people in the world, two-thirds of whom are on our continent. Simply demographically, 11% of our total population has got HIV or AIDS. So we'll have 10% of parliamentarians, 40 parliamentarians, 5 or 6 ministers and deputy ministers, maybe one premier living with HIV or AIDS. We haven't heard from them.
Hmm.
And the reason isn't, I don't think, external stigma. The reason is an internal fear, an internal mechanism of condemnation. And I don't speak of this as a scientist. I speak of this with very, very humble personal experience of it, because I only spoke out about my own HIV status in 1999, which was nearly 13 years after I'd been diagnosed.
Hmm.
At the time, I was confident, it was just after Gugu Dlamini had been murdered in Durban, I was confident that I would be joined. I'm a proudly gay man, I'm a white person, a white gay man, I'm a minority in this epidemic. I was proudly confident that I would be joined by other leaders who were heterosexual and black, and it hasn't happened. I'm still the only person in the whole continent of Africa holding public office who's spoken about my own status. So that, I don't mention that as a claim to anything, because it's just a fact. I mention it to illustrate the depth of the internalized stigma that still keeps people silent.
Mm-hmm.
And practically, that stigma still explains people who don't want to be tested, people who've been tested but don't want to come forward for treatment, people who don't want to talk to their families, to their loved ones, to their colleagues. It's still the pall of silence and fear that rests so heavily on this epidemic.
Mm-hmm. So it was 16 years since you disclosed your status, and you thought that other leaders may follow. But considering that it hasn't happened in 16 years, it's sort of, you wonder how long it might take for particularly leaders, but also a lot of other people facing internal stigma to confront these issues.
Well, a lot of working class and poor people speak about it freely, and we have the Treatment Action Campaign to thank for that.
Yeah.
And we have the Treatment Action Campaign's wonderful T-shirt, HIV Positive, which President Mandela put on when he visited Zaki Ahmad. And that was 13 years ago.
Yeah.
So a lot of people do speak about the HIV status. I meet many people who come up to me and talk to me, but they're mostly poor people. The internalized stigma is mostly amongst the middle class and the political and the social elite.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, it's such a deeply personal issue. I've never, ever called upon anyone to state their HIV status because it's a deeply personal issue. All I've been able to do is to say, if you can bring yourself to it, two things. The one is that you will be rewarded with love, affirmation, approval. You will not get despised and rejected. And the second is that you will have an enormously beneficial effect on other people. I can only say that, and I will not call on other people to speak out about their status, because the issue is just too difficult. I wouldn't call upon someone with hypertension or with cancer or with insulin-dependent diabetes to make themselves an example, and I couldn't do it in the AIDS epidemic either.
Mm-hmm. And what are the effects of internalized stigma? I'd imagine there are medical problems where it means you may not go and get tested, you may not go and get your treatment, you may end up spreading the disease. But it also seems, you know, you talk about sort of the pall that hangs over you. It seems like a soul sort of corroding condition.
That's quite a good phrase. Well done. A soul corroding condition at 5 to 2 on a Tuesday afternoon. That's pretty good.
There we go, Greg. The constitutional court judge is approving of your way with win.
You can use that in a judgment.
I will indeed. A soul corroding condition. But it's correct, because the main effect of internalized stigma is death.
Is death.
Yeah. And we still have almost 200,000 deaths a year. And they are unnecessary deaths, almost all of them, because HIV treatment is so magnificently successful. I've been living on ARVs for almost 18 years.
Yeah.
You know, I cycle cycling marathons several a year. I'm very fit and healthy. I work very long hours, and I feel privileged and joyful to do so. I'm not boasting about it, but I feel very, very lucky to do that.
Yeah.
So it's a completely manageable medical condition. But people are scared to be tested, scared to be diagnosed, scared to go for treatment. The second effect of internalized stigma is that our prevention strategies aren't as successful as they should be. We still have approximately, the figures are very hard to verify, but I think the last HSRC household survey estimated new infections at about 400,000 a year. And I think those infections are partly the result of our not being able to talk about it. They're also the result, if you've still got a minute or two, guys, and tell me when your news is coming up.
Yeah.
They're also the result of the fact that, of course, we have to understand the complexity of changing people's health-seeking behavior. It took the United States 50 years to bring the smoking rate down from 44% to 18%, and still nearly 1 in 5 of Americans today smoke, even though we've known for 50 years, more than 50 years, that smoking causes cancer, heart disease, other problems, hypertension.
Yeah.
So, you know, people sometimes ask me, why don't these young black kids just wear condoms? And my response is, I want to throw a pie in their face, because it's such superficial arrogance.
Mm.
Why don't you just stop smoking? Ask a smoker in your family. It is very, very difficult to change to health-seeking behavior, and so much more difficult when we don't speak about it. We're at least speaking about smoking and its hazards, and it's much more difficult with HIV prevention, and that's the second cause, the second effect of stigma and internalized stigma.
I mean, I hear you. Behavior change is not really something we can change overnight. And your journey, as you've mentioned, has been received with affirmation and with support. I'm quite curious, Justice Cameron, have any high profile or people or public holders of public office, have they privately confided in you that this is maybe something they're considering, or maybe, I don't know, has anybody sort of seeked your advice about considering going down a similar route?
No, in fact, the opposite has happened. When people holding public office have spoken to me, and I've said very cautiously, at a later stage, after the diagnosis, after stabilization on treatment, after sharing with family, I've said to them, you know, it might be that you could consider talking about this publicly one day. In some cases, I've never heard from those people again. And I don't blame them. I don't condemn them. I think it's just too momentous. And the momentous effects are, Greg, what was your phrase?
Soul corroding
condition.
Justice Cameron, thank you so much for not only for coming on the show, but for your extremely brave journey in sharing your story with the country and with the world, and I think paving a way for other people, high profile or not, to really to be open about what they're going through, and hopefully we can finally sort of turn the tide on fighting the issues of HIV and AIDS and stigma and discrimination. So it's really just a big thank you.
Thank you, and pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
Okay.
Cheers.
Fantastic. That was us speaking to Justice Edwin Cameron, Constitutional Court Judge. Please go out and get his book, where he discusses sort of his journey on coming out as living with HIV and AIDS and some of the issues around stigma and discrimination. If you're just tuning in, you've just missed the Daily Maverick show on Cliff Central. Please, please go out and get the podcast and share it with all your friends and tell us we're amazing.
And subscribe.
There we go. Subscribe on iTunes. Greg jumps in there. We will see you next week. Have a great week ahead.
CliffCentral.com.